From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Supporters say a Broadway-style theater would attract more people downtown and enhance an already vibrant arts community. Skeptics, though, say the larger venue isn't needed and funding should be spent on existing arts groups. So how have performing arts centers really affected communities which made the investment? Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker is bringing experts from Durham, North Carolina, Dayton, Ohio, and Denver to talk about their experiences building and operating large theaters in their cities. Today on City Views, they join me in studio to discuss how an art center played out in their communities. Plus, the story of an Iraqi translator who died unexpectedly last week. Now family and friends are trying to raise funds to fly his body back to his mother in Iraq. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Salt Lake City continues to push for a Broadway-style theater downtown, but how would such a facility really affect local arts groups, and what would it bring to the community economically? Salt Lake City has brought in three experts from Denver, Durham, North Carolina, and Dayton, Ohio, to share their experiences about building a performing arts center in their cities. And they'll be at a community forum tonight at 7. But today on the program, they're giving us a preview of that conversation. We're talking about performing arts theaters, lukewarm applause or standing ovation. Joining me this hour, Ken Neufeld is president and CEO of Victoria Theater Association and owner and operator of the Schuster Center in Dayton, Ohio, which includes a 2,300-seat theater, along with a 1,200-seat theater, a 235-seat theater, and a 150-seat theater. Ken Neufeld, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. Just a clarification, those are actually separate buildings.
Yeah. Very good. Okay. Also with us, Reginald James Johnson. He's interim director of the Durham, North Carolina Department of Community Development. He serves as the liaison to Durham's two city-owned theaters, the 1,000-seat Carolina Theater, built in 1926, and the 2,800-seat Durham Performing Arts Center, the largest theater in North and South Carolina. And Reginald Johnson, thanks so much for being here.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Also with us, Randy Weeks, president of the Denver Center for the Performing Arts, and he serves as a governor for the Broadway Theater League. Denver Center for the Performing Arts is part of the second largest performing arts complex in the world after Lincoln Center in New York City. And Randy Weeks, thanks to you.
Well, thank you and good morning.
Later on the program, we're talking about the life and the untimely death of an Iraqi interpreter who called Salt Lake City home. But first, performing arts centers. How do you think a larger venue would affect downtown Salt Lake City and arts groups throughout the valley? We invite you to join the conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Gentlemen, I want to start with a little bit of a scene setter. What was the local theater scene like before you built your performing arts center, the big one? Describe the landscape and what the largest venue was in town. Let's start with Ken Neufeld.
Sure. In Dayton, Ohio, we had a roughly 2,500-seat hall called Memorial Hall, which had been really not kept up in a very antiquated facility. Bad sight lines, uncomfortable seating, poor technical opportunities for Broadway companies, small stage. And as Dayton developed and some buildings remained derelict, particularly a large downtown department store, there was a move to put the final piece on the downtown development of Dayton physically by doing something with this department store. And so the Schuster Center for the Performing Arts was built on a roughly a square block space, and then a parking lot to serve the Schuster Center was built on another block. So it was kind of the last urban development ingredient in downtown. The theater scene in Dayton is a mix of mostly smaller producing companies, and most of those companies still exist today. They the one that is resident in our community or in our facility, the Human Race Theater Company, has much better facilities now than they had at the time.
And the large venue built in 2003,
understand. 2003.
Yeah.
Which is the home of the Philharmonic Orchestra, the opera, the ballet, our Broadway series, and a number of other sort of concerts and one-off events that we do.
All right. The situation in Durham, Reginald Johnson, you built a new facility in 2008.
2008, that's correct.
Okay. What was the scene like prior to this the groundbreaking?
Prior to building the DPAC in 2008, we have the 1,000-seat Carolina Theater, which is our historic theater built in 1926. It also has two cinemas attached to it that show movies. But we also have the Durham Arts Council facility, which has a theater that's small, probably about 200. And then there's the St. Joseph's Historic Foundation, which is our African-American cultural center, which has what was a former sanctuary is now a performance hall that hosts about, seats about 350. So we have several nonprofits that do arts work around the city, and they use those venues. We did not have Broadway prior to building the DPAC.
And that was in
2008. That's
okay.
Correct.
In Denver, I understand you transformed an existing facility into the 2800 theater. Am I right?
That's correct. What we currently call the Buell Theater mm-hmm. was actually the old auditorium. It was an arena, and that was completed in 1991. Prior to that, we had the auditorium theater, which was actually built in 1906, renovated in the mid-50s, and that was the primary theater that was available. And the problem there is it was shared with any touring product that was available, the symphony, opera, and ballet. So programming was definitely an issue.
Hmm. I think it's fair to say that there's a lot of enthusiasm in the public here in Salt Lake City for a new Broadway-style theater. There's also a lot of skepticism questions about, is the larger venue needed? Can't our existing theater stock accommodate what we need it to? These resources could be better spent supporting local existing arts organizations. I'm wondering what kind of debate occurred in your communities prior to you taking the plunge and pouring public financing and a lot of time and effort into a new facility, a new Broadway-style facility. Let's get the Denver picture. What was the public discussion like?
There really wasn't. It was a different time, and we were in a different place back then.
And this is 1991. Right?
1991, but actually the formation and the creation of the Denver Performing Arts Complex really started back in the mid-70s. So there really wasn't the same kind of a debate going on because we were really one of the main projects that started the sort of the comeback of downtown Denver. And it was really a vision of a few people, our founding chairman, for example, that a major performing arts complex in downtown Denver could be a building stone to bring back, the revitalization of downtown.
Sure. Reginald Johnson, what's happening? What was it like, the public discussion in Durham?
I would share with you that the public discussion in Durham was very intense. The initial proposal, and let me start off by saying that our theater was built for economic development, was the primary purpose in building our theater. And the actual concept involved a larger theater, probably about 3,000 or 4,000 seats, in using one of the prominent national promoters, and many felt in our community, arts community in particular, but community in general, felt that they did not like the big box concept of art and productions. And so we began a series of community meetings. Some of them were very heated, also taking in the ideas of citizens and going back and reformulating, and that's how we came up with the idea through this evolution process, through these community meetings, of having a theater that focused on Broadway primarily. Now, of course, we do many other things, but that was an evolution that transpired between 2004 to 2005 over a series of community meetings held in various venues.
Hmm. How about in Dayton? Was there rancor?
Yeah, there was. But part of it was they didn't want to abandon Memorial Hall, which had a lot of sentimental value in the community. But, you know, there was artistic reasons for getting out of the hall and moving to a better facility, and mostly that was driven by the orchestra. But also Broadway and you know, the genesis of our facilities was in the early 90s. The Broadway Hall, which is the Victoria Theater, which we also own and operate, is only 1,200 seats. So we didn't have the economics and we didn't have the stage space to really accommodate Broadway musicals. And that was something that our community expressed a need for and a desire to have. And so, you know, it was like Randy. You know, it's a different time and financing was in a different place than it is now. But, you know, there was a kind of a mix between artistic and economic development that kind of sealed the deal for us.
Hmm. Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker is proposing spending $100 million to build a 2,500-seat facility, possibly tapping into downtown property taxes. And I'm wondering how your communities paid for this, for your facilities. Was it through taxes? Was it through a bond?
Right.
How did you do it? Neufeld?
It was a mixture of there was some philanthropy involved. About $80 million in about $40 million in philanthropy. The state was a big contributor over three budget cycles. The county was a big supporter. The city put in some money. Even the Regional Transit Authority got into finding a place to find federal money that went into the creation. And then we did some work with. There were some bonds that were attached to it, and those have all been paid off subsequently. Mm. So a real mixture of private, public.
Reginald Johnson in Durham?
We used about three main different sources. One, we used certificates of participation that the city actually pays with through hotel motel occupancy tax. Basically, we borrowed about just over $30 million, and we pay back that every year through up to $1.4 million annually from the hotel motel occupancy tax. We also were able to secure some naming rights from various entities within the community. And Duke University, Durham is the home to Duke University, provided us with $7.5 million to the building of the DPAC.
Hmm. And what was Denver's financial situation? How did you fund this?
It sounds quite similar, actually, to the other cities. It was definitely a mix of naming rights, personal giving, bond issues. And in Denver, we have what we call fondly the seat tax, the facilities development tax, FDA tax. And that's a tax on each ticket that's sold, and that's used to service the bonds. And the Broadway, the interesting component about the Buell Theater and the Broadway work that we've done over the 20-some-odd years is that even though the FDA tax hasn't gone away, just the presenting of the Broadway shows has retired the debt for the renovation two times over.
You mentioned that one of the primary reasons why a community does this is to revitalize a downtown and to boost the economy. I'm wondering how the first year was in your respective cities. Was there a payoff, or did it take some time to see economic benefit? Ken Neufeld,
well,
in Dayton?
You know, the first couple of years of your facility are going to be gangbusters because everybody wants to go. You could program somebody reading the telephone book and people will still want to go because it's just the thing to do.
It's new.
It's new. It's glitzy. It's fun. It's fantastic. You know, the economic payoff is hard to measure down the road. But, you know, for Dayton, it was we built that facility, or the city, you know, the city and the county built that facility and us as the owners of it, because we really needed that in our community. We're 45 minutes from Cincinnati that had a new performing arts center. We're close to Columbus. We're close to Indianapolis. And Dayton was behind the scene. We needed to do something to put us into a favorable position with people who are coming into town, thinking about bringing their business to town, thinking about trying to recruit senior executives or other people into their companies. And, you know, a performing arts center is an amenity. It's a piece of the infrastructure that smart cities have to have. And that's what people are looking for. And it's just paid off for us in our city. It's paid off a lot over the last 7 or 8 years that we've had the Schuster Center.
What do you mean a lot?
Well, we know that people are interested in the kind of level of arts activity that they're familiar with in other centers, particularly bigger cities. And it's one of the top three things that they're looking for when they come to a city, when they're considering relocating there. It's, you know, it's cost of housing, it's education, and arts amenities. So if you don't have the arts amenities, then it's a problem. And the feedback that we get from business owners and people who run large hospital systems and everything else is, thank goodness we've got the Schuster Center, because that really says that we're a sophisticated community to a lot of people coming in and looking around.
Reginald Johnson, economics.
In Durham, we use a model where we go into the city goes in with public dollars first to spur the encourage private dollars to come in behind. We have a successful experience with that. In 1994, we built a new ballpark, and for the Durham Bulls, which was very profitable, very successful. And after that, we had a $200 million investment came in behind that right next door. We're using the same basic model where we'll go in with public dollars to build the theater and in the effort to spur private investment. I will tell you that, share with you that when we opened in November of 2008, most folks will remember what the economy was like in November of 2008. We opened to a sellout, and the restaurants in the spring of 2009 in downtown reported that they were doing very well. Hmm. Most folks will remember what happened in 2000, what was going on in 2009. And actually, we've had several restaurants come online in the downtown area since then. That's one example that I would share with you.
We need to take a break. We're speaking today with Ken Neufeld from Dayton, Ohio, Reginald Johnson from Durham, North Carolina, and Randy Weeks from Denver. They're in town to share their experiences about their performing arts centers at a community forum tonight at 7 o'clock in the auditorium of the Main City Library here on Library Square in Salt Lake City. For more information, you can visit the City Views page on our website, kcpw.org. We're talking about the benefits, perhaps the challenges, of a Broadway-style theater in downtown Salt Lake City. We'd love to hear from you. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Again, we need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. A lot of speculation surrounds a plan to build a downtown style, Broadway style theater on Main Street. What's the experience been like for Denver, Dayton, and Durham, North Carolina, three cities that built and run large arts venues? Joining me this hour, Ken Neufeld, president and CEO of Victoria Theater Association and owner-operator of the Schuster Center in Dayton, Ohio. Reginald Johnson, interim director of the Durham, North Carolina Department of Community Development, serves as liaison to Durham's two city-owned theaters. And Randy Weeks is president of the Denver Center for the Performing Arts. We invite you to join us, 801-355-TALK. What do you think about a new Broadway-style theater in downtown Salt Lake City? Gentlemen, there's a concern here in Salt Lake, and I think maybe, Reginald, you alluded to it, that these mass market, you know, broad appeal productions may squeeze out demand for more challenging theater, more, you know, experimental theater. I'm wondering how that's played out in your communities. What's been the effect on local theater groups of bringing these big blockbusters in? Is there still audience demand for the more challenging stuff that's out there? Ken Neufeld?
Well, you know, I think it is a problem for other organizations when we go on sale, because we monopolize our box office and we do the ticketing for other groups. But, you know, really I think that the real question is, how can we help build audiences for other organizations? And, you know, if you look at our audience, and we've done a lot of analyzing of our audience, there's very little carryover between our Broadway audience and our theater audiences for other companies. In fact, it's about 6 or 7% where you have common people coming or common audience members. So what? But when I'm doing The Lion King and I'm bringing 70,000 people into my building over 4 weeks, I am bringing a huge number of people to the theater who maybe have never been to the theater. In fact, half of my single ticket buyers for The Lion King had never been to my building before. Huge number of people. It was 26,000 single tickets were from new people in our community coming to the theater. And I guess my argument is that we form a kind of a base of a triangle of broad base audiences. And as your organization or as your offerings get more sophisticated, the triangle goes up. But we're still at the bottom and we're feeding people up the triangle. So a certain percentage of people that come to our audience, come to our shows are going to get introduced to other people's arts activities. And so we're really audience development for a lot of other organizations.
Reginald Johnson, what's been the experience in Durham? Have you found that the larger venue is it's horning in on the audience, the theater audience, and hurting smaller theater groups who certainly can't fill a 2,000-seat theater?
No, that has not been our experience. One of the things that I would also share with you is that during the last year, last fiscal year, so ending June 30th, about 357,000 people attended performances at the Durham Performing Arts Center. If I am have a production, which the Carolina Theater, a smaller theater, does have productions, they market to that audience. They have a display in the Durham Performing Arts Center, advertising the Carolina Theater and its performances. We also let the Durham Arts Council advertise their programming, as well as the St. Joseph's Historic Foundation. So these are actually expanding markets for those organizations that they're able to market to more people. And, you know, I think that that's a positive thing, and I think that they have found that to be very positive.
Hmm. Randy Weeks, the experience in Denver, has it crippled real challenging, cutting-edge types of theater to have this big, large venue of blockbusters?
No, and actually one of the interesting concepts about the way the Denver Center for the Performing Arts is set up as an organization is that we cover both sides of the aisle. We do the Broadway presenting, and we also have a Lort Theater Company that does 12 to 14 plays a year. But we were finding the same thing that Ken was mentioning, is that our crossover in the subscription base is in the single digit percentages, but we are drawing the Broadway shows draw large numbers of people down to the Performing Arts Complex, and I have been in Denver for quite a long time, and I've watched the city develop. And the vibrancy of the local theater scene is really quite incredible. I mean, there are five or six other what I would call major small theater groups that have come along in the meantime. Just two or three weeks ago, I went down to a brand new 500-seat performing arts center that was built south of Denver, and ironically is being run by about half of the people that used to work for us up in Denver. So we're kind of feeding the cultural economy, and once again, I mean, it's a term that will probably be used a few times today, but a rising tide lifts all boats.
Well,
the more exposure people have to an art form, the more they'll want it.
Well, yeah. As Ken from Dayton mentioned, he's building a broader base, but is that really the case? Have you been able to pinpoint how many new people are coming to the theater, or are you just ticket shifting? You're shifting from the smaller venues from the smaller theater groups to the larger Broadway, and you're not getting a broader base of support.
No, you're not, because there's no crossover. We know from studying our audience what other kinds of venues they go to, what other kinds of arts activities they're engaged in. When we did Wicked, the symphony, the Dayton Philharmonic Orchestra, actually captured more buyers from the Wicked audience as new subscribers than we did. So it kind of went in the reverse, and people really got excited about other kinds of art forms. And so, we were helping develop that audience for the Philharmonic. So, there is lots of market out there.
Right.
And our market is very, very different than the market for the opera. It's very different than the opera for challenging theater work. It's just a different game. Some people like baseball and some people like football.
Reginald Johnson from Durham, North Carolina. You mentioned that you also have a historic theater. It's 1,000 seats. Here in Salt Lake City, we have the Capitol Theater, and we have had Broadway touring shows come here. We've had The Lion King and Les Mis and et cetera, et cetera. I'm wondering, you know, if your current theater can accommodate these larger productions, why make the investment in an even larger theater like Durham, North Carolina did? Why did you do that if you already had a theater that could bring these touring productions into town?
That's a good question. That's an important question because we did not have a theater that had the capacity to hold a Broadway play in Durham.
Hmm.
The Carolina Theater has a small stage. For Broadway, their stage requirements, if you think about a Broadway play, they'll take about 2 weeks sometimes, a week, to bring in all of the equipment. It has to have the right height, the right width, the right wing space to be able to accommodate a Broadway production, which in many respects can be massive. We didn't have that, and we wanted to have that and have that in our community, not just for our residents, but also our residents in the region, to have them come to Durham.
But, you know, the idea of having a retrofitted old theater is never really an acceptable option. It's like a city that looks at its sewer system and says, well, you know, we can just patch up those cast iron pipes. They'll last another 10 years. But that's not really the smart thing to do in the long run. You really have to look at these buildings as part of a city's infrastructure. These are part of a smart city's infrastructure and what a modern city needs to look like in order to attract business, in order to attract people to their community, in order to provide the kinds of amenities that people are looking for so that they stay in the community, particularly in downtown. Downtown, you know, a lot of people want people to move to downtown. These amenities help people do that.
Our time is running short, but I want to ask a final question of each of you. This is a huge investment, $100 million. So a lot bigger project with a heftier price tag than the facilities that your community supported. Is this the right time? The economic climate is not great, as we all know. If you had to make this choice in your respective city, would you do it now? And Randy Weeks from Denver.
The only advice that I would give on that topic is that you probably should have done it 10 years ago. And, you know, putting it off another couple of years, it's just going to cost more. It's something I believe that the city does need. To spin just for a second off of what Ken was talking about, the amenities that our patrons are looking for, you know, bathrooms, accessibility, and so forth is becoming much more a point of concern for management of buildings and so forth. And just, you know, looking at some of these older structures, people just won't go anymore.
Reginald Johnson, if Durham had to do it today, would you do it today?
I think that we would. One of the things that we in Durham, we look toward the future. And we have visions about what we want our future to look like and what we want the tapestry of the quality of life to look like. Even now, in this economy, the city of Durham is embarking on the largest neighborhood revitalization project that we've ever done in this economy. And so we think that we need to move forward. We can't just move forward in the good times and then pull back in those times that are challenging, because life goes on and our children and our children's children we need to leave something for them to benefit from. And so just because the economy is down, does that mean that everything comes to a halt and we wait until the economy gets better, then we move forward? We have to keep moving forward regardless.
Yeah, I would agree that there's a certain economies of scale that you can utilize in times of recession that might be very helpful in terms of putting this facility in at a really good budget point. And, you know, in 30 years, when everybody's still enjoying this amazing facility and it's done everything that it should be doing, you know, I don't think anybody's going to be talking about the bond issue at that point. They're going to be slapping themselves in the back saying, wasn't that a great decision?
Ken Neufeld, president of the Victoria Theater Association and operator and owner of the Schuster Center in Dayton, Ohio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Our pleasure.
Reginald Johnson, interim director in community and economic development from Durham, North Carolina. Thanks to you.
Glad to be here.
And Randy Weeks, president of the Denver Center for the Performing Arts. Randy, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
These gentlemen will be participating in a community forum tonight at 7 at the City Library in downtown Salt Lake City. More information is on the City Views page on our website, kcpw.org. We need to take another break, but we'll be right back. We'll be up next with the courageous life and the unexpected death of an Iraqi translator who lived in Salt Lake City. But first, a quick break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Diyar al-Bayati was a former Iraqi interpreter who accompanied U.S. soldiers on more than 200 combat missions. He was badly wounded, and he came to Utah as a refugee, and last week he died unexpectedly. Now his family and friends are trying to raise the $15,000 it will take to return his body to his Iraqi homeland. Joining me now to talk about al-Bayati's story is Debbie Clark. She's a former refugee caseworker and a friend of Diyar al-Bayati. If you have questions, please call us, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Debbie Clark, I understand that you met DR when you were working with a refugee relocation group. What were your first impressions when you met him?
Well, I was originally quite nervous meeting this young kid who lost both his legs while interpreting for our military in his country. And DR put me right at ease. The first thing that hit me is his wonderful smile and the bright light in his eyes.
And you were nervous. You were the caseworker.
Yes, I was. Yes, I was.
What made you so nervous? Was it just the circumstances of his landing here in Utah?
Well, it was the circumstances of how his life was so altered through the war in his country that our country was involved with. So.
DR was just in his early 20s when he arrived in Utah. Is that?
Yes, he had just about 22 and a half.
He had already had so much life experience and a lot of hardship as an Iraqi interpreter. How did he become an interpreter for the U.S. military?
Well, when DR told me that he was going to school for quite a while, and when the war came to his country, he, money was scarce, and he felt that he had an obligation as the eldest son to help support his mother and his younger brothers, and he stopped going to school and took a job as an interpreter. He had spoke very, very good English.
Mm. Let's hear his voice. Diyar al-Bayati was on KCPW in 2008. I want to play a clip from an interview that he had with KCPW's Laura Jones and maybe then have you respond to it. This is Diyar al-Bayati and KCPW's Laura Jones talking about his first mission with U.S. forces.
So that first mission, what was, do you remember that first having to interpret?
Yeah, it's been like, you know what, normal mission because I'm new one and the unit's been new too over there. So Jeff just gave us like mission to secure the area around the base over there. So we start chat with the people. So I start the first translation over there. And you know what? The first words I translate over there.
As long as they're not swear words, what were they?
Yeah. We've just been there, and some kids, they just run away. They've been very scared. They said, oh, the militia, they kidnapped my family, and they threatened us to kill us too. This is the first words I translate over there. Trust me, like, I've been in a very scared situation too over there.
That's Diyar al-Bayati speaking on KCPW in 2008. Debbie Clark, when you hear that, I think it takes a certain kind of person to be able to not buckle under the pressure and to stand your ground in these really terrifying circumstances.
Absolutely, and DR was that type of person. He felt at the time that he was doing the right thing for his country and for his family, and he he developed quite a bond with the men and women he served with from our military over in Iraq.
And he seemed to be very frank about his concerns about his safety and knowing full well what could happen.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Dr. Albayati accompanied U.S. soldiers on something like 200 combat missions. Did he ever talk to you about those experiences in the battlefield prior to his injury?
Yes, he did. He had reached the decision that he was ready to get out because it was getting scary, and people around him were being, you know, killed or injured. He had seen other interpreters be injured, and he thought that, you know, it was time for him to be done.
Let's hear another clip from that 2008 interview with Dr. Albayati. Here he's talking about some of those safety concerns.
Do you become used to that kind of danger as your time goes along, being an interpreter?
Not really.
You don't start to sense safety at all?
At all. Like, all the time, you expect you will hit something or you'll be in the middle of shoot fire, and this happen all the time, but you cannot use about it.
So
at all.
Why did you keep doing it? Was it a paycheck? Was it helping to rebuild your country?
Of course.
Was all of that?
Yeah. Because, like I said, I believe in something. How can, like, you have a plan, or you have a road, or you have streets, you got to walk on it. You cannot stay in the middle and just say, I'm just give up.
Dr. Albayati speaking on KCPW in 2008. When I hear that, I hear this sense of, I've got this mission to perform, an idealism, in fact.
Absolutely. He was very, you know, he had a vision of a better life for himself, for his country, for his family, and, you know, he tried his very best to help, you know, fulfill that dream.
We're speaking with Debbie Clark, a former refugee caseworker, also a friend of Dr. Albayati, who died last week here in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Dr. suffered some really grave injuries during his time in the military, and that's eventually how he wound up in the U.S. and in Utah. I want to play one more clip from this 2008 interview, and this is Dr. remembering the day that he was injured, and then we'll talk about that.
And you cannot imagine just the whole fire burning in the whole street. I don't know what's going on.
The street's on fire.
That's what I saw. Just fire coming, my face closer, closer, closer. I just scream and I cannot hear my voice. After that, everything's just been quiet for a couple seconds, and they start shoot fire all over against us. Still inside the Humvee, because I cannot walk over there. I don't know why I cannot even move myself, because in the same moment, I don't know what's going on to me. I said, oh, maybe it's just the aftershock, and I'll be fine. I'll just get out. So we still shoot fire from the Humvees, and I think after half an hour, they opened the gate to the Humvee. Half an hour. They just opened the gate in hard way. They use other Humvee just to pull the gate because stuck. So just pull me out, and they went. They just pull me out of the Humvee. I've been, like, my height is just like 185 centimeter. So it's very high. So they pull me out from the seat and just dig in the ground. There's something wrong. Where is my legs? I said, I just want to see my legs. So I just tried to up my head to see what's going on. They just put me down. They didn't let me see what's going on. But I immediately know there's no legs over there at all.
Dr. Albayati, who's speaking with KCPW's Laura Jones in 2008. Debbie Clark, truly a terrifying situation for him. Describe for us the extent of his injuries.
Dr. lost both his legs. The amputations were quite severe. One was, you know, very high up, close to his hips, and the other was just midway through his thigh. And then one of his arms was rendered pretty well useless through the injuries. Not to mention, probably some traumatic brain injury from concussion. And
yet in this conversation, I mean, he's very frank and almost optimistic. I mean, there does seem to be some sort of positive vibe I hear in his voice. You know, he understands what happened to him, but he didn't seem to be distraught at that point. Can you describe what happened between 2008 and last week? How has his how had his situation kind of changed?
Well, I think at the beginning when DR was here, he was pretty excited to be in this country. I think another thing, too, is when he talked about his injuries and what happened to him, he did talk about it from almost being a distance and looking, you know, on.
And so I kind of detached.
Yeah, he was a bit detached from it. So after he got here and he started having surgeries, and the first surgery was to help correct his arm and hopefully give him some use of his arm, and there were many complications to that, and he had many surgeries on it. I think over time he became quite discouraged. He had a lot of nerve pain. He wanted legs, and he had this hope that he would have some sort of mechanical legs, that he would walk again. And his dream was to walk again and see his mother. Things just didn't happen the way he envisioned. There were so many complications. He was so far from his family. He had, you know, suffered with some depression, PTSD. He started isolating himself. You know, I saw him about a month before he passed away, and he just was not the same DR, you know, a year ago. He just didn't look well.
In his remarks or in his demeanor, what do you mean when you say he doesn't? He didn't look well.
In his demeanor, his eyes no longer had a sparkle to him. One of the things he told me was that his mother was quite worried about him. That she commented to him. They talked via the internet, video chatting. That he didn't look well. She didn't feel the doctors were helping him, and he felt she didn't understand. He was very homesick for his family, and he told me, "I just want my mom."
Hmm. He died unexpectedly last week. What do we know about the cause of his death?
At this point, my understanding is the county medical examiner could not come up with a definitive cause of death. So it has been passed on to the state medical examiner. And as of yesterday, there has been no cause of death listed.
But as you mentioned, he was very homesick. And
yes.
His family and friends now want to return him to his native country of Iraq for a proper burial.
And that was something DR said to his best friend. He said, if something were to happen to me, please, please take me, make sure I get back to Iraq and bury me in Iraq.
Hmm. What's it going to take to make that happen?
Well, it's going to take, first off, the state giving a cause of death and releasing the death certificate. And then from there, the best estimation, you know, at this point is about $15,000 to transport his body back to Iraq. Right now, the mortuary is holding him, and they're going to keep him until that time where we can transport him.
How much have you raised? And if people want to contribute, how do they do that?
Well, as of yesterday, I looked at the account, and there was just under $3,000 in it. And anyone can go to any Wells Fargo and go in there and tell them they want to donate to the Dr. Albiate Benefit Fund, and they will take their donations.
And we'll put some information on our website, kcpw.org. Finally, Debbie Clark, how would you like Dr. Albiate to be remembered?
Oh, DR was an amazing man, and the strength that he had, he was gracious. He was, he would just give you anything to help you out. He was a patriot to our country and to his country, and I just want to remember that light in his eyes always and the smile. He had a beautiful smile.
Debbie Clark, a former refugee caseworker, also a friend of Dr. Albayati, who passed away last week. Debbie Clark, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jennifer.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Eric Ray and Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music, and you can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. Also, follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Tomorrow, a proposed ski lift from Park City to Big Cottonwood Canyon is raising eyebrows, and we'll talk about the plan and the controversy that's coming up tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.